Virtual charter schools, the ultimate in school choice, or a model that's asking for trouble? Today, we check in with our partners at Chalkbeat Indiana to learn the latest on two online charter schools who are in the process of losing their charter. We'll also hear about other cases where virtual schools have shut down in recent years, and later, examples of how to do them well, this hour on All In. I'm Matt Pelser. School choice has long been touted as an important evolution in public schooling, but private companies taking advantage of state funding models have tarnished this dream of having online charter schools that perform at or above the level of traditional schools. What do you have to say about virtual charter schools? Have you or someone you know enrolled in one of these schools? What was your experience like? Comment on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. First, this news. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Last week, online charter schools, Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy, got some bad news. They would be losing their charter. This hour, we'll use that news to open a broader discussion about the state of school choice. What do you have to say about virtual charter schools? Have you or someone you know enrolled in one of these schools? What was your experience like? Comment on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Here to catch us up is Stephanie Wong from the nonprofit education news organization Chalkbeat Indiana. Thanks for being here, Stephanie.
Thanks for having me.
But before we jump into talking about specific virtual charter schools, a lot of us have never experienced them, and we've only experienced brick and mortar schools. A teacher stands in front of the class, and the rest of us sit and learn. Online learning is a whole new ballgame. This is learning through your computer, oftentimes entirely through your computer. Can you talk about what a day at a virtual school looks like for a typical student?
Yeah. So if you think about a kid who goes to a brick and mortar school, they wake up, they get ready, they go to school, they sit in a classroom and take lessons with a teacher and maybe 20 other students, go home, do some homework, do it all again. With a virtual charter school, you've got kids who wake up and then they log onto their computers. And so the lessons are happening all on their computers. They're interacting with their teachers on their computers or on the phone, interacting with other students on the computer. It's basically like you're going to school without ever actually having to go to a school.
Sitting on the couch as opposed to at your desk.
Right. And so there's a lot more flexibility there. You can learn at your own pace if you want to learn a little faster, if you want to learn a little slower. It's not like you're stuck in, you know, moving at the same pace as an entire classroom.
Are these often recorded lessons or are they live lessons? I would think live lessons would incentivize people to show up.
Schools do it in different ways. So there are some schools where they want you at home logged on at 10 o'clock for a certain kind of lesson. But then there are schools where you can go through the entire thing in a couple of days if you want to, or a couple of weeks if that's what it takes you.
And it's important to point out that these schools are not only online, but they're also charter schools, meaning that they're publicly funded, but they have more freedom to operate like a private entity. What do these schools offer that traditional school doesn't?
Well, it's just a more independent model. So you've got a charter school that is not part of a district. It can be an independent charter school run by its own school board, overseen by an entity called an authorizer. And they have a little bit more flexibility, is what charter advocates say, to do what they want and to be able to move a little bit more swiftly to offer a niche type of curriculum than an entire district that's trying to move with all of its kids and all of its teachers.
Do we see any patterns in the types of students that are drawn to these schools?
So when virtual charter schools first started up, they were meant to be for certain types of kids like elite athletes or kids with serious medical issues who were looking for flexibility that they couldn't get at their traditional public school districts. But what we're hearing more and more now as enrollment at virtual charter schools has grown tremendously over the last couple of years is it's becoming much more of a catch-all for kids. So you're getting kids who have maybe been bullied in traditional schools, or you're getting kids who have fallen behind, or kids who are struggling to learn in that kind of environment who are looking for a different type of setting. Kids who feel like their needs aren't being met in traditional public schools. And so now you've got a really big bucket of kids. It's no longer just those little niches.
So then it seems like part of the appeal of charter schools is that they have the flexibility to experiment how they educate. And so Hoosier Academy's virtual school was Indiana's first online charter school, and they opened in 2009. Some of the major challenges included high dropout rates, failing the I-STEP, high turnover. What went wrong with Hoosier Academy's virtual school?
So when Hoosier Academy Virtual went through, there was an argument that they made about serving a different type of kid, being a non-traditional environment for a non-traditional student. And so they weren't, they said that was the reason for not producing the same types of academic outcomes that you would hope to see in any other school. Hoosier Academy Virtual got four different chances to prove that it could perform well. And ultimately, had several years of failing grades from the state, and there were multiple times in which the state could have stepped in to intervene. They did in 2017, but they let the school stay open and just implemented different restrictions on the school. So, like, they couldn't take new kids until they could show that they were improving. And ultimately, their oversight agency, Ball State University, their charter authorizer, decided not to renew the charter because they weren't living up to what they said they would do.
So while they were closing their doors, several other virtual charter schools had developed. By 2017, though, every full-time charter school in the state received an F grade. Among them was Indiana Virtual School and its sister school, Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy. Both are currently in the process of having their charters revoked and are facing closure for a number of reasons, one of which being the schools had inflated their enrollment numbers by almost double the actual number of students, which means that they're wrongly collecting millions of dollars of state funding. How does enrollment affect the funding of these schools?
So just like every other public school in Indiana, virtual charter schools get a certain amount of money for each kid that they educate. And so there's an incentive there to enroll more kids, because as you enroll more kids, you receive more money.
Yeah. And how was the school inflating this enrollment data? As I understand, there were a lot of ways.
So there is a big question about whether the school was claiming to have students that were never really going to that school. So you had kids who had at one point gone to Indiana Virtual School, but then moved away, was an example that came out in this state report, and then somehow appeared back on the virtual school's rolls, even though they were still living out of state. In one case, there was a student who had died and was still being claimed as a student at Indiana Virtual School, and the school was still receiving funding to educate this student as though he were still going to classes.
So as a result, then, the state is asking for the return of $40 million from Indiana Virtual Schools that never went toward educating students, and it wasn't being spent on educating. If it wasn't being spent on educating students, where in the world did it go?
I think that's a big question that's outstanding right now, and state auditors are looking into the financials for these two schools over the last 3 years to try to find out.
What do we know then about whether or not the state will actually get any of that money back?
Well, the way that they've tried to recover the money is to cut off any public funding for these schools going forward until they recover the amount of money, the $40 million that they're looking for.
So that's sort of a way – that's sort of the way – it's not like that this company is going to sign them a check or something like that. It's just them cutting off, and this future expected money will no longer go to them.
For now, but I think there's a big question about whether they can recover $40 million like that when the schools are in such trouble and looking to be closing soon. And so there could be future legal action to try to get this money back from the schools.
Now, this isn't the first time that red flags have been raised around Indiana Virtual Academy. In 2017, Chalkbeat reported that millions given to the school through the state had been funneled to businesses linked to the founder of Indiana Virtual Schools, Thomas Staunton. One such business was AlphaCom. How is AlphaCom related to Indiana Virtual Schools?
So AlphaCom was the organization that was providing the management, the day-to-day for the virtual schools, so providing the technology services. It's not unusual for charter schools to contract with companies to provide those services. The question in this case was whether that was a conflict of interest, since Thomas Staunton had an interest in both the virtual school itself, the nonprofit behind the virtual school, and the company that was being contracted to run it.
A 2015-2016 audit revealed that Indiana Virtual Schools had paid AlphaCom $6 million in management fees, $2 million in software fees, and Stoughton Sons Company also charged the school over $1 million for IT and marketing. Was this conflict of interest apparent from the get-go?
Well, that's the question that our investigation raised and why it wasn't reported earlier. There's an expectation with nonprofits to not have these conflicts of interest because you're not supposed to be able to profit from a nonprofit. And so it would have been the job of the school board or the school authorizer to look at this conflict of interest and decide whether it was kosher.
So whose responsibility is it then to act on conflicts of interest like that? Is it the authorizer or who is it?
Well, there's a number of places, right? So the school board could have decided, but of course, Thomas Stoughton sat on the school board for a while. The authorizer could have decided that that was a conflict of interest that they weren't willing, you know, to accept. There's different layers that it could have gone through. And I think right now what we're seeing is the state auditor looking at these to see whether or not it crossed a line.
In this case, the authorizer is Daleville Community Schools. This is a small rural district, and they were responsible for overseeing a statewide virtual charter school. And as a fee for monitoring the schools, Daleville received 3% of the charter school's funding, amounting to more than $1 million last year. I mean, is this just a fair fee, or is this itself a conflict of interest as well?
A lot of people will say that's a pretty perverse incentive to put out there. So, you know, an authorizer might be incentivized to keep a struggling school open because it's receiving this fee. That was a concern that was raised over virtual charter schools. And, you know, if the schools continue to struggle, one of the things the state can do is step in and say, hey, we're going to cut down this fee that's going to the authorizer while you're trying to improve your school.
But if a district is economically incentivized by the virtual school that they oversee, are they less likely to shut it down then?
That's what some people think.
Yeah. We know how dismal the education results have been from Indiana Virtual School and how messy the management's been. But some still want it to remain open. Why is that?
So virtual charter schools are a really important choice for some kids in Indiana. You've got 13,000 kids who are currently enrolled in a virtual charter school, a full-time virtual charter school across the state. And so for a lot of these kids, this is the best choice for them, the best option for them, particularly if they feel like they've been failed by a school before. And so the big question that's in front of the state of Indiana is how can we preserve these options while making sure they're also good options and serving kids and graduating kids and getting positive academic results.
Amidst all this turmoil, it's also been reported that the school officials haven't been effectively communicating information to students about the closing and that these students have been left blindsided. Are the schools currently open or are they closed?
There's mass confusion over that right now, and a lot of families are feeling left in a really uncertain position. The school officials say that they're still open, but they're obviously operating with a skeleton staff, and having been cut off from state funding, they don't have money coming in. And so there's a big concern about whether they can continue to operate as a school when they've got no money coming in. So right now, the schools say they're open and that kids should be able to continue going to classes, they should be able to get their transcripts, and they should be able to transfer to other schools. But there is an end date. And right now, Daleville is considering whether to make both schools shut down at the end of September.
There's a lot there, but there's a lot at stake for Indiana students. Stephanie Wong from Chalkbeat, Indiana, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
And hope you hang around for the next few segments. Up next, we dig deeper on virtual charter schools in Indiana with former member of the State Board of Education, Gordon Hendry. State Representative and Chairman of the House Education Committee, Bob Boehning, will be with us as well. And you can chime in on social media. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We especially want to hear from you if you yourself have been directly involved with virtual charter schools. What's been your experience? I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. As we just heard, virtual charter schools in Indiana have been in a rough patch for a while now. Again, if you have experience with virtual schools, good or bad, we want to hear from you. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Here to help us understand more, our former member of the State Board of Education, Gordon Hendry. Mr. Hendry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And State Representative Bob Boehning, Chairman of the House Education Committee. Representative Boehning, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
You've been a strong advocate for school choice. The argument for school choice kind of mirrors the argument for a free market. When people have choice, they often buy the best products, or in this case, they send their kids to the best schools. How would you make the case for school choice?
Well, I would continue to advocate that parents are the best people in a student's life to decide what's best for their son or daughter or, you know, child. So I still think that I definitely believe that school choice is advantageous. I think the other thing that's happened, we've seen across the state, the largest segment of school choice is actually public to public choice. And now we've seen a lot of public schools that are out advertising come to our traditional public school or et cetera. So I think it has actually created some competition and improved overall performance and focused on some of those key factors that just parents look into when they're trying to decide where their son or daughter would best meet the needs, what school would best meet the needs of their son or daughter.
What does the menu of school choice look like right now? Virtual schools, innovation schools, vouchers, tax credit scholarships, et cetera. There are menu options. Are there ones that have been more successful or popular than others?
Well, the single largest choice is traditional public school to traditional public school. That's the largest number of students have made that choice. Second would be charters, traditional, what we would call brick-and-mortar charters generally are fall into the second category, and vouchers would be third. Innovation Network schools kind of fall into a category that they're kind of hybrids between one or the other. So I think you could just look at, you know, non-public choice, charter choice, or traditional public school choice.
I'm curious, is there a timeline? I know that the state legislature all the way up to the governor as well have sort of advocated for this, but is there a timeline, a goal timeline perhaps for having, say, this much percentage being brick-and-mortar schools, this much percentage being charter schools, this much being, you know, other, I suppose? Or is it just let's put the options out there and see who chooses what?
We have set no goals. We really have not put any caps on anything. It's really driven by consumer preference. So there's never been, at least in my career, there's not been any caps put on any of those options. Nor really have we strategically gone out and said we want X percent of students in this type of school. It really is market driven as to what parents or caregivers think are the best for their students.
Charters certainly offer that element of choice to parents. And are you you're committed to making sure that dollars follow children in education funding. How do you respond to people who suggest that school choice takes away necessary funding from schools who most need it?
Well, number one, I would say if you look at the funding that actually follows a student in a charter school receives only state grant money. A traditional public school student receives state money plus the $3,200 on average per pupil that's generated by property taxes. So that's, you know, they're not necessarily apples to apples. And then if you go to the other non-public school choice, the maximum amount of state revenue is 90% of the state general fund. That's the maximum. The average is around 76%. So if you really, you know, talk dollars and cents, you could almost argue that select an alternative is actually saving taxpayers money. And the flip to that is if you're in a traditional public school and I leave that $3,200 that traditional public school has because I'm a student there continues to stay in that school. So it's not being diverted anywhere else. So the money that's available to spend on the rest of the student population is actually increased.
Charters certainly offer the element of choice to parents. If a school fails, does a school just fail? Or is the state responsible for getting those schools back on track?
Well, in charter situations, in charters and vouchers, both vouchers have a higher set of accountability than charters or traditional public schools. When the charter schools rolled into accountability, we actually had a shorter accountability timeline on charters than we did traditional public schools. We have since changed and made all of them on a four-year timeline. But it is with a charter, you're signing a contract, so to speak, with an authorizer. So I'm a group of teachers that want to come together. I have a different concept of a school that I'd like to propose. I go to an authorizer, which would be, you know, any of our state universities can do it. Ball State's the only one that is elected to do so. Several non-public universities have taken the opportunity, or the mayor of Indianapolis, or the state charter board. Those are all authorizers. But I go with that concept to them. And then they create a charter, which is a contract that says, I will at X date have so many students. This is the performance I will have, and continue that pattern on through the period of that charter. The authorizer has the ability and the responsibility to police and basically hold accountable the organizer for their performance, and whether it's economic, which has happened in the Daleville situation, or whether it's student performance, which is also in question in Daleville, that is the responsibility of the authorizer. Now, state board, we have given state board the oversight as well to step in, and state board can say, okay, authorizer, you authorize this school. We're going to reduce the amount of fees that you can collect. State board can say you can no longer authorize any more schools. State board can also close it if they so chose. So we try to put oversight in several different levels. Contrasted to that to traditional public schools, if you're a failing traditional public school, state board can elect to get into and maybe take it over. We've taken over, I think, seven in our history. But generally, they don't. They come in and try to make some suggestions and try to help improve it. So there's probably a little – there's definitely more oversight on charters and on vouchers in many respects than are even our traditional public schools.
Gordon Henry, you're a former member of the State Board of Education, and you were also the chairman of a committee tasked with looking into online charter schools specifically. And the committee was formed after Governor Holcomb called for immediate attention and action, quote unquote, after news broke about how poorly Indiana Virtual Schools was both performing academically and allocating their state funding. What were the goals of this committee?
Well, we've been following virtual charters for a number of years, and really, as I think you mentioned in an earlier segment, they've been growing exponentially in the last few years. So we had seen some serious problems at the Hoosier Academy School. I had actually proposed reducing the administrative fee to the authorizer in that instance as a penalty. But really, we formed the committee because we have seen these problems at virtual charters. The governor obviously called for immediate action, and we formed as a state board a committee to look at it. We called in every single authorizer and every single virtual charter in Indiana to hear from them directly. We went out and toured one of the online schools, their kind of their headquarters, where their teachers sit and interact with the students. We heard from national advocacy groups and best practice groups to understand the national issues and how other states are dealing with virtual education. We heard from just a number of other experts to advise us as to what we might do in Indiana to improve virtual education. Over the course of an entire year, the committee of three state board members looked at these issues, and we made recommendations to the full board last December, some very tough recommendations to take action to better regulate virtual education in Indiana. The full board adopted almost all of those recommendations to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly considered those and passed Senate Bill 567 a few months ago, and it was signed into law by the governor. I think the key thing, two things in that legislation that are critical. Number one, in terms of the authorizers, which I think is the most important element here, you need to have good authorizers who are supervising the schools. Only statewide authorizers can charter virtual schools. So Daleville School, you know, it didn't even have 1,000 students, yet it had several thousand in a virtual program. They clearly could not do a good job overseeing that program. Will no longer down the road be able to charter virtual schools. So it will only be the statewide authorizers who are best equipped in that oversight capacity. Number two, the legislature delegated a significant amount of authority to the State Board of Education to oversee and make policy for virtual education. So, for instance, the state board will be enacting regulations to manage the onboarding of students. So to ensure that students who are going into virtual education programs are actually equipped to benefit from those programs. And there's just a number of other recommendations that we'll be looking at or ways to better regulate virtual education, hopefully improve it. Because I agree, you know, with a lot of the comments, this is something that we have taken very seriously. The state is spending tens of millions of dollars on virtual education in Indiana, and we need to make sure that those taxpayer dollars are well spent, that the children who are enrolling in virtual education are getting a good education, just like we demand of our brick-and-mortar schools. And as it relates to charter schools generally, you know, I worked for Mayor Peterson back when he became the first mayor in the nation to be able to charter a school, a public school. And at that time, he took it very seriously that the program that he was enacting to create charter schools would be very rigorously run. So taken very seriously. And make sure those schools are doing a good job of educating the kids. And I think there's a higher expectation for charter schools. That's kind of the compact. There's less regulation, less oversight, but you're supposed to do a much better job of educating the kids. And I think that should also apply to virtual education. We should hold virtual education to very high standards in the state, and we need to make sure that our taxpayer dollars are well spent.
Representative Boehning, were these sorts of problems expected as growing pains, or were they unexpected?
I think as technology has moved forward, we've found problems that had not been expected. I think it's the one thing that Gordon says, I think is totally correct. We're not talking about just – unfortunately, this dialogue was always about virtual charters, but we're really talking about virtual education, because there are programs across the state that are virtually provided – in a traditional public school that struggle as well. It's not just a charter issue. I think the charter issue, they have grown exponentially much faster. But no question, technology has probably moved faster than sometimes what our rules and regulations are. But I do think we've always had the safeguards in place from the very beginning that, you know, accountability kicks in at 4 years. The authorizers always had control, especially when it comes to financial management. Some of the things that, you know, happened in the most recent Daleville situations were things were clearly against state law. I mean, you can only make a law and somebody has to enforce it. You know, even the example of Daleville being an authorizer, we actually changed a law, I think, 2 years ago that said no longer can school districts authorize virtual programs like that, charters, because we were concerned then that they don't have the capacity and the scope of practice to be able to manage a statewide footprint. In fact, last year, Nineveh schools, I think, came in front of state board, wanted to do a statewide charter, and apparently there was some ambiguity. They were arguing that they had the authority to do it. I talked to state board staff over the summer. I thought clearly that they didn't. I think state board eventually said they eventually backed down. Mm-hmm. But that language actually was even clarified even more in 567. So back to your original question, I think we had safeguards in there, but we expect the authorizers to kind of be the first line of enforcement, then followed up by state board.
Marianne writes on Facebook, and you can join us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. She asks, who are the board members of each Indiana online charter school, and who made the decisions for those schools? How would a parent know when and where board meetings occur for their school, and how to speak at those meetings? As I understand, it's not quite set up the same way.
They have board boards. Those should be available. If you can't find access through the school itself, you can go to the authorizer. They should be able to provide you a complete list as well as information in terms of when their board meetings are. We've had discussion over the last several years about how to and make sure that the public does have access to these meetings. But my suggestion is if they don't know, if you can't go online, then to go to the authorizer and they can provide that information to the parents. But it should be something that is transparent. We're not – I don't think there's anything – you know, the Daleville situation, I think there was just multiple, as Stephanie was saying, probably multiple flags that were kind of popping up that people should have started taking attention – paying attention to. Daleville definitely should have started questioning reactions and different contracts along the way. And unfortunately, it got to a situation where, you know, state board had to get involved. The legislature actually, I would say the legislation that passed in 567 is kind of we've been over the last several years adding more and more regulation to our virtual charters. We had an engagement. They had to have engagement policy several years ago. We put more language in there this year that talked about engagement, making sure that if a student's enrolled, making sure that they can tell now by technology if they're actually on the computer and engaged in that. Onboarding is, to me, a big first step for them as well, because I think many times what has happened, parents don't realize the amount, or the caregivers don't, the amount of responsibility that they have by allowing their student to do their provide these services at home. There's one other issue, 567, that I think hopefully may help us as well, is, and that is in virtual education. We have had a problem in our accountability system over the last several years of kids exiting our traditional public schools to homeschool. And that number in different schools is double digits, a significant problem. They're leaving and going, and they're credit deficient, and they're showing up at our virtual programs.
Great insight into the issue of virtual charter schools in Indiana. Gordon Hendry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Representative Bob Boehning, thanks for making time.
Thank you.
We're discussing virtual charter schools following the news last week that Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy are in the process of losing their charters for a number of reasons. Up next, more perspective plus examples of virtual schools doing well in Indiana with Dr. Jeff Butts, superintendent of the Metropolitan School District of Wayne Township, and Ronald Sandlin with the State Board of Education. That's 2 minutes away. And again, your questions and comments on social media. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We've been discussing virtual charter schools in Indiana. And so far, it hasn't been the rosiest of pictures, but there are examples of online schools doing well in Indiana. Here to chat with us is Senior Director of School Performance and Transformation at the State Board of Education, Ronald Sandlin. Good afternoon. And Dr. Jeff Butts, Superintendent of the Metropolitan School District of Wayne Township. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And we're taking your questions and comments on social media. Did you or someone you know have a positive experience with virtual schools? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Jeff, as a superintendent, you helped oversee the development and opening of Achieve Virtual Education Academy, a public virtual high school. What makes Achieve Virtual Education Academy different from a virtual charter school?
That's a great question, and this is actually our second go at creating virtual educational opportunities. Indiana Online Academy was our first, of which we then transferred over to Central Indiana Education Service Center. They're not a degree-granting program, but they do offer virtual classes that can be transcribed back to a student's home high school. It gives them opportunities to free up their schedule for other things like performing arts and study halls or other opportunities that they can take if they take some of those courses in the summer or also during the school year. When we had the opportunity under then State Superintendent Tony Bennett to create Achieve Virtual, we did so because we knew that there were certain students who were not being successful in a traditional brick and mortar. That's the significant portion of our student population. We do have a few students who are pursuing professional acting careers, Olympic athletic opportunities, and so this fits their schedule quite well in the way that we offer it. We wanted to make sure that we did not purchase the curriculum. There's a lot of canned curriculum that does not necessarily meet the Indiana academic standards. And so we utilized our own teachers that are teaching in traditional classrooms to create the curriculum. We have an e-learning team that supports our students in the same way that not all students are good learners in a virtual setting. Not all teachers are good teachers in a virtual setting. It takes a specific talent and a specific skill set to be successful in that. So we have an e-learning team that works with our teachers to make sure that they are being given professional development so that they can be the very best virtual teacher they can and service the students that we have. We also made sure that we created a virtual public school. We registered with the Department of Education and create a school that from the outside looks just like any one of our other 17 buildings that we have. The difference is, of course, these are students who are all over the state of Indiana that do not come into the schoolhouse to do their learning. We have attendance requirements. We have requirements for our teachers to have office hours to make sure that there's engagement and interaction going on with our students. But to be realistic, we also have to understand that there are students that will not be successful in this model. They need to have a strong support structure at home, and they need to have some self-motivation in order to be successful. And so we have steps in place to make sure that we're reaching out to parents when students are not logging in. And if it gets to a point in time where they have no longer engaged in the class, we remove them from our rosters. So we're not carrying students beyond the time that they're active in class. We have students who, by the very nature of virtual education, this is an alternative school. Students are coming to us typically behind in credit. So the current accountability model doesn't match real well with the virtual education system because these students may not graduate in that 4 years because depending on where they are when they come to us. So while we had 77 graduates this year out of a class of 200 or out of an enrollment of 250 students, many of those students were not in the four-year cohort. They were five, six, seventh year in high school, but they were determined to continue on. They didn't want to earn their high school equivalency diploma. They wanted a diploma, an actual high school diploma, not the what we used to call the GRE or the
GED.
GED. Thank you. Goodness, couldn't pull that out. And so we welcome those students as well and work with them to make sure that they can earn a high school diploma.
Well, and at the end of the day, your school is your district rather is responsible for Achieve Virtual rather than being a third party authorizer and having a role in sort of general oversight. Do you think that that self-containment works to your advantage? I mean, it sounds like it does.
We do because for us, we control the curriculum. We control the teachers. We control the academic environment. We have a principal that acts just like any other principal that we have. We have staff that have to have the credentialing for the state in their content area. And so for us, we believe that us running it ourselves, and quite frankly, the students are enrolled in an Indiana school. They're being taught by Indiana teachers with Indiana curriculum, and the tax dollars that are being spent on their education are staying in Indiana.
Part of the problems among Indiana virtual schools have been the issue of truancy. How does your virtual school handle that issue?
So the state has compulsory attendance guidelines that are part of statute, and we follow those compulsory attendance guidelines. We work with our students. When they have not logged in for 2 to 3 days, we are making sure to reach out to their parents, to reach out to them, to find out what's going on. Is there an illness going on? And illness doesn't play quite as big of a role in a virtual setting because they can still log in when they're sick and work from, as Stephanie said, their couch or their bed or anywhere like that. And so we do reach out when we find that a student is disengaged. We do not carry them on our books. We make sure that we take them off of our rosters so that those students are no longer part of that enrollment.
We have a bit of a charged comment from Tommy on Twitter. He says, charters don't give students more choice. Instead, they siphon funds from local neighborhood schools, which hurts all students and makes schools more segregated. Right now, we're talking about a non-charter virtual school. But what do you think of that comment, Ronald Sandlin?
You know, I think the conversations about school funding are obviously nuanced and get very deep, but the assumption baked in that comment is that the funding is inherently belongs to the traditional public school. And I think in the state of Indiana, policy has kind of set a vision that funding belongs to families and to find their best way to educate their children within a set of guidelines and guardrails. Those guidelines and guardrails take the form of funding following students to whichever school they wish to enroll. Another program that kind of captures that is the Choice Scholarship Program. So while we understand the push and pull and the strains that choice put on local school corporations, Dr. Butts, I'm sure, can talk about that a lot. And those are important considerations as we think about choice policy. But at the end of the day, it's about whether you believe public education is a public good and it's about educating children, or if you believe it's an institution And if you believe it as an institution, then you might have a comment or feel that particular way. And that's a valid, I think, and justified comment. I think the policy here in the state of Indiana has dictated that we believe it's a practice, and it's educating the public, and we should use our tax dollars to do that in an efficient and effective way.
Stephanie, can you elaborate on the tension between traditional schools and charter schools?
Well, it's been going on for years. I think that we're not getting any closer either to resolving this fight, because I think that people are on different sides of the issue. And there are people who feel really strongly that traditional public schools should be supported, and that support for other choices takes away from those traditional schools and puts them in a tough position. And then you've got people who are really adamant that kids need more choices, and that we should be providing choices for kids and meet the needs of kids, regardless of what that looks like, of school type, regardless of school type.
Ronald Sandlin, what does the State Board of Education think about using that A through F scale for virtual schools? Is that a different that's a different arena, essentially? And is that appropriate in this case?
It's a really interesting question. And actually, we heard a lot about that, a lot of testimony on that from experts during our virtual charter committee, who had similar statements as Dr. Butts shared around how our current A to F model applies to a virtual setting. A couple facts for you that I think often aren't talked about. At Indiana Virtual School in the 17-18 school year, the median kid enrolled in 11th grade, and the median kid stayed for 1 year. We know that graduation is a multi-year engagement for a child. It is a minimum four-year engagement, if not longer, if they're taking courses in middle school or going beyond in the fifth, sixth, seventh year. So right now, once that child enrolls in Indiana Virtual in the 11th grade, oftentimes under-accredited or behind in their academic career, Indiana Virtual then assumes all of the responsibility for graduating that child, and the sending school, or the school from which they came, completely loses any accountability. So we've talked a lot about, during the virtual committee hearings, about shared graduation rates. Is there a way that we can kind of proportionately distribute points for where a kid is enrolled across those 4 years of their graduating cohort? Again, at the Achieve Virtual Academy, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Butts, the majority of students are enrolled in 12th grade. Over 60%, I believe, of their students last year were in the 12th grade, assuming that they are taking a lot of those kids in, as Dr. Butts mentioned, in the 12th grade, and they're under-accredited, yet they assume that full responsibility for graduating them within 1 year. So I think there are a lot of conversations to be had. We want to make sure that there is clear accountability, because at the end of the day, these students need and deserve a high-quality educational option. The question is virtual education the right spot for them at this point in their academic career?
Jeff?
I'd also like to add, and I completely agree with what Ron's saying, understand that the MSD of Wayne Township has offered this opportunity because we believe that children should have those options. Because of the nature of the students that are attending Achieve Virtual Education Academy and the graduation rate that we have, we understand that that is going to bring down the overall graduation rate for our district. Ben Davis High School will be well above 90%. We think closer to 95% this year. Ben Davis University High School, our early college program, will be at 100% again this year. Achieve will be somewhere around 45 or 50%. And so we will take a 2 to 3% hit overall in our graduation rate. Our Board of Education is willing to do that because we know that we're providing students an option. And matter of fact, 77 of them now have a high school diploma, a better opportunity for career advancement, a better opportunity for lifelong learning, better opportunities because of Achieve than they would have had that school not existed and they not attended that. So for us, it's about educating children. And this is an opportunity for some children to be successful. We also, it's important to know, we have relationships with districts across the state who send their students to us while during the traditional school day to take a class that maybe they can't offer because they don't have the staffing, they don't have the capacity, they don't have the number of students to make a full class. And so they can take an AP class or a dual credit class, all of which have gone through the NCAA clearinghouse for us. And then that gets credited back to their school, which then helps them with their overall letter grade and their CCR standards. So those are good things also for other school districts in the state. We really wanted to open that up and have that opportunity so that we could partner and help all students across the state of Indiana, not just in the MSD of Wayne Township.
Not to derail from the point, but we do have a comment from Donna Petrates, who served as a spokesperson for Daleville Community Schools. And she says, contrary to conventional thought, the supposed monetary incentive does not in reality exist for charter authorizers. Authorization money can only be spent on expenses related to the oversight of the charters. Authorization fees have also paid for Daleville students to take virtual classes as part of the monitoring process. She goes on to say much of the language on increased oversight of virtual charter schools has been provided by Daleville through testimony provided by the SBOE by Daleville Superintendent Paul Garrison. And it should be noted that Daleville was the whistleblower to the IDOE and the State Board of Accounts once they had the legal access to data and confirmation of questionable practices. I'm glad that we're kind of coming back to this issue of these fees to the authorizers. Anybody care to comment on those points made by Donna on Facebook?
I'll just speak briefly about fees in general. It's another topic that we heard a lot about during our testimony during the virtual charter committee. And it was about the incentive structure. And so we wanted to make sure in our recommendation, or the board wanted to make sure, excuse me, in their recommendations that we kind of looked into that, which is why Representative Maining spoke earlier about the restructuring and the prohibition against local school corporations chartering or authorizing statewide virtuals. And it was to address that authorizer issue and the capacity issue that I think is kind of implicit in that comment, that there's a capacity issue and an ability to effectively do this no matter how much funding is available.
Dr. Butts, as we zoom out of Indiana and we look for models of what other virtual schools look like, you can see both struggles and success stories. And earlier this year in California, virtual charter school leaders were indicted for also inflating their enrollment numbers, collecting far too much state funding, funneling it to companies linked to their business interests, very similar to what we heard about here in Indiana. A virtual charter in Ohio, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, was also caught inflating numbers. Actually, Ronald, let me ask you this question. Is there a national learning curve happening where this is concerned? It seems like we're going through a lot of growing pains.
Again, I think experts told us that. We had folks specifically from Ohio, from the Fordham Institute, who came and spoke to us explicitly about ECOT, or the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, and how these conversations are happening across the country. But it is essential that we have these conversations within the context of children and supporting learning needs across the entire system, and also with the recognition that fraud is illegal, and we have laws on the books to prosecute that when it does take place, and that we should do that aggressively. And obviously that's outside of our purview, but kind of that's where the conversation has landed. And I think there is learning going on across the entire country.
Jeff, you're also a past president of the Indiana Association of Public School Superintendents. You've had the opportunity then to interact with stakeholders of these issues from all across the state. Is there a certain attitude that superintendents tend to have toward virtual schools?
I wouldn't say towards virtual schools. I would say towards the privatization of education. And so I think when you look at the traditional publics, most of the comments that I hear are the biggest rub between the different choice options is the different levels of accountability and transparency. And so those are really the conversations, because these models are successful in other states. There are very harmonious relationships between different choice options in other states. It just hasn't evolved to that point yet. In Indiana, I think we're getting better. But I think the more you talk about private companies coming in, for-profit companies working with nonprofits and utilizing those taxpayer dollars, that's where the rub comes in. Because our children should not be the next capital venture, and nor should their education. And if that continues to be, I think you'll continue to see kind of this sour taste in people's mouths for the relationships that exist between for-profit and not-for-profit organizations.
This is sort of an adjacent issue. So I'm thinking of the failure of ITT Tech. And when that happened, the argument came up that education is not a market that works. It's something that has to be funded. Is that kind of where people in your periphery sort of fall into as well?
Well, I think we've seen it play out in multiple occasions where it hasn't worked. It doesn't work a long time, because eventually that model gets – people find out what's going on, and it gets exposed, and all of a sudden it shuts down. And unfortunately, many of these groups and organizations just recreate themselves, rebrand themselves, go for a different market, and it happens again. And so, you know, it's a big issue across the country. It's a big issue for Indiana, and I think it's one that we'll continue to work on. I'm proud to be a public school superintendent and to be able to offer opportunities for our children, and we accept all.
As a note, the superintendent of Daleville Community Schools, Paul Garrison, was contacted for comment on this show. Also, Mary Jane LaPointe, the attorney for Indiana Virtual Schools, Lori Fieser, the principal of Indiana Virtual Schools and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy. They were all contacted. None were available for comment. I want to thank our guests for this segment, Superintendent of MSD Wayne Township, Dr. Jeff Butts. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And from the State Board of Education, Ronald Sandlin, thanks for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Today's show was produced by Maggie Galon. I'm still on the air because my wife still hasn't gone into labor. Baby Watch 2019 continues. Will I be here Thursday? I hope so, because we're going to have a lot of fun. Thursday, we're going to go to the fair. We're talking about state food fair vendors competing for your taste buds with decadent deep-fried delights. And we're also going to take a virtual tour of this year's grounds, maybe even a little wine talk, sampling too. Who knows? We can dream. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.